Welcome to the podcast on emerging leadership. I'm Alexis Monville. Today, we are thrilled to have with us Radhika Dutt. Radhika is an innovation and product management expert. She is the author of the book, Radical Product Thinking, The New Mindset for Innovating Smarter. Radhika has worked globally across diverse sectors from startup to giants. Welcome, Radhika.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm so excited to be here with you today.
Thank you. Radhika, could you please introduce yourself to our audience and share a bit about your background on the work you do?
Sure. So my background is that I started out as an engineer. I studied engineering at MIT, and I became an entrepreneur soon after. So my first startup was called Lobby 7, and we started this. It was myself and a bunch of other co-founders. It was five of us in total. And we started it while we were still in our dorms at MIT. And, you know, my whole experience has been through entrepreneurship and then working at larger companies and making mistakes along the way. For example, you know, this first startup, Lobby 7, was where we caught the disease hero syndrome. What I mean by that, right, is our tagline and vision statement was to revolutionize wireless. And our tagline was enlightened wireless. And you ask me now, what does that mean? What did you mean by revolutionizing wireless? I really am not sure. All we knew was we wanted to be big. That was all that mattered. And that is hero syndrome. So that was the first disease I caught. And along the way, you know, there were other product diseases that we caught. So that was my background where, you know, I had worked in these different organizations and kept seeing product diseases. And over time, you know, as I learned from these product diseases and learned to do better, I then watched other people make these mistakes and had to watch them suffer through it. So the burning question for me in 2017, after, you know, almost 20 years of experience was, is it that we're all doomed to learning from trial and error? Or is there a way we can learn to build products systematically so that we can avoid these product diseases? And that's how radical product thinking was born.
Wow, excellent. And I'm glad you're touching on the product diseases. That's really something that is interesting. Tell me that in radical product thinking, you're describing the approach, but you really start to say it's really a mindset change. And I believe there's an exchange between Alice and the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland that is inspiring that or making it easier to understand.
I just wanted to ask you which way I ought to go.
Well, that depends on where you want to get to.
Oh, it really doesn't matter. As long as I can...
Then it really doesn't matter which way you go.
Can you tell me more about that mindset change?
Yeah, so the mindset change is that, you know, we have believed for a while that the way we build good products is through iteration. And this is the Silicon Valley mentality that has trained us to say, you know, just try different things, put things in the market, see what works. And you just keep pivoting and iterating until you figure out what works. And the problem with this mindset, right, is it masks the fact that you literally have 2 to 3 pivots before you run out of money or momentum. And no matter how much money you have, you know, just what happens is teams lose momentum because they feel like you really don't know what you're doing. We're just trying different things. And it gets demoralizing when you don't feel like you've learned something and you know what is the right next thing to do or what are you going to try next and why. And so this is the mindset that needs to change, this iteration-led mindset. And what we need to be instead is more vision-driven, meaning we need to have more clarity in terms of what is the problem that we're solving? What are a set of hypotheses that we have? What is our planned action? And how will we test whether it's working? A more systematic approach to summarize is really what we need. You know, while I say that, right, when I say that, it sounds a little obvious. So then the question is, wait a minute, how did we even come up on this idea of being iteration-led? How did this mentality even come up? And the answer to that is that it really is baked into the VC business model. So let's think about how the VC business model works and how this came up in Silicon Valley, right? VCs invest in 10 different startups, and they need only one of those startups to make it big. Everything else, in fact, they want it to fail fast because you don't want to keep pouring money into something that is middling along. You want it to either die or go big. And so this mentality of fail fast, learn fast, and you know, try 10 different things, it really came up from this VC mentality. And so while this meant that there were a few unicorns that succeeded, it doesn't mean that this is how you build products. This is really survivor bias that came out of that VC model. So this isn't necessarily what is good for entrepreneurs. And this is what we need to realize so that we can see examples of how organizations have built world-changing products. And what is needed is a more systematic and deliberate approach.
So what would be the pillars of the radical product thinking philosophy when you're looking at that?
So the first pillar is the idea that your product is your mechanism for creating the change you want, meaning that your product, you know, until now, we've always thought about a product as a physical or a digital thing, and we look at the success of the product as, you know, just the end goal in itself. And instead, what we need to do is think about our product as a mechanism for creating the change we want. And so this means, this brings me to the second pillar, this means that your product is only successful if it creates that change. So it means you have to start with this clarity of what is the change you want to bring about before you go and build that product. And then the third pillar is the idea that you can build that product very systematically, and meaning, in other words, to use engineering speak, you can engineer the change that you want to bring about very systematically by starting with this clarity of what is that vision, what is the end state you want to bring about, then translating into strategy, into priorities, hypothesis-driven execution and measurement, and into culture. And those five elements, vision, strategy, prioritization, hypothesis-driven execution and measurement and culture, those five elements are what radical product thinking gives you as a step-by-step framework to be able to create these visionary products.
Mm. And to be clear, can you tell us a little bit more about that first element of the framework, the product vision? Because when I hear vision, I'm already tempted to think about the grand vision and the high ambition and that are not really grounded in reality. But I believe it's not really what you mean.
Exactly. We have to really discard so much of what we've ever learned until now about what is a good vision. You know, we've learned that a good vision is big, broad, kind of like what I described about my startup Lobby 7. You know, the vision that says revolutionizing wireless or, you know, disrupting blah, blah. We've learned that that's a good vision. And instead, what I've realized is that, and this is the radical product thinking approach, a good vision is very detailed, and it describes the answers to the who, what, why, when, and how questions. So what I mean by this is, whose world are you trying to change? And it's not everyone's world. What exactly is the problem? And what's the solution that they're using today? Then we can answer the third question, which is, why is the status quo unacceptable? And this third question is the most important for me, because if we cannot answer why the status quo is absolutely unacceptable, we really have no business building a product. We can't disrupt just for the sake of it. We have to know why what is there today doesn't work. Then we can say, when will we know that we've arrived? Meaning, what does the end state look like when this problem is solved? And then finally, the how. This is finally where you can talk about your product and you can say, okay, how am I going to bring this about with my product? And so let me give an example, because, you know, even when I know I have to answer the who, what, why, when, and how questions, if I start with a blank sheet of paper, it's really hard to answer these hard questions. And so the radical product thinking format gives you a fill-in-the-blank statement so that you can focus on answering these questions instead of getting stuck in wordsmithing and finding the perfect words, right? So here's an example of a vision statement for a startup that I had many years ago. Today, when amateur wine drinkers want to find wines that they're likely to like, they have to pick attractive looking wine bottles at the wine store, or they try wines that are on sale. This is unacceptable because it's really hard to learn about wines this way, and it leads to so many disappointments. We envision a world where finding wines you like is as easy as finding movies you like on Netflix. We are bringing about this world through recommendations algorithm that matches wines to your taste palette and an operational setup that delivers these wines to your table.
Excellent. Okay. That's a product vision. That's not a grand vision. That's not grandiose necessarily, but it's very clear what is the problem that it answers, what change it will create for those wine enthusiasts. So yeah, I really like that.
Exactly. And you know, one thing you'll notice is this is not a righteous vision where I'm trying to change the world for everyone. It can be a very specific group of people, but the clarity it brings is I had not told you anything about my startup at all, but hopefully at the end of it, you knew exactly what we were doing and why we were doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So next up in the framework is strategy. Can you give us a little bit more about that strategy?
Yeah. Let's talk about, you know, kind of what's the problem today with how we do strategy. Most company strategies that I look at read something like this. It'll say, okay, we're going to build XYZ in terms of a feature set or in terms of products. And then that's going to, you know, mean an investment of X million, and we're going to launch it in these markets, and the return is going to be blah. This is the kind of strategy that is very fluffy, I'll say. So what is a good product strategy instead? The mnemonic is RADICAL, or RDCL, where we have to ground it in what is the real pain point. That R in the RDCL is for real pain points. And real is there on purpose because we want to differentiate that from the imaginary pain points. So we have to ask the question, what makes someone come to the product? That question then leads to this next question, which is the D, which is what is our solution to that pain that makes people come to the product? That's the design. Then the C is for capabilities. That means asking the question, what's the underlying engine that powers this solution? And then finally, the L is logistics. That means asking the question, what is the business model? How are we going to support this product? What's the training required? You know, all these questions of how will we deliver the solution to the customer that very often get left out. You know, when we build products, we say, okay, first we'll build a product and then we'll bolt on some business model at the end without thinking about it comprehensively, right? And that's what we want to avoid with this question L. And so let me walk through an example maybe of how this RDCL comes together. So again, if I go back to the wine example, right, and our company, the startup Likely, the real pain point was people were coming to this product because, you know, if you wanted to learn about wine and try wines, maybe I don't want to read all these magazines that use language that feels intimidating. So I want to learn in this easy way and have fun as I'm learning about wine and find wines that I like. So that's the real pain point that makes someone come to the product. So the design is, you know, I cannot then ask you questions about your tastes by asking you things like, well, Alexi, how much tannins would you like in your wine and how much acidity would you like in your wine? You know, that's those kinds of questions. I don't know. It's hard for most people to understand, to kind of answer with clarity, right?
Yeah, that's expert questions. Oh, nobody will know how to answer it. Or, yeah, 1% of people will absolutely know how to answer it.
Exactly. And so we ask questions that are much simpler. For example, I can figure out how much tannins you like based on how you like your tea or coffee. If you like it black, you like more tannins than if you like your coffee with milk and sugar. Or if I look at which fruits you would like in a fruit salad, I can tell how much acidity you like on your palate. So we can ask you a quiz based on all of this. That's the design. The capabilities then is we have to map this to a set of wines. So we have to look, create a database that maps all of, you know, wine varietals, etc., to such tastes. And then logistics, this is where we think about our business model. You know, we could charge a business model where you buy one wine at a time. But then what we came up with was, you know, we could charge a subscription model by creating courses, wine courses, where you graduate through courses by tasting these different wines and learning along the way. So these are ideas of how this all comes together. Oh, and I'll give you another example of logistics, by the way. You know, we didn't have all of these wines that we were supplying. We didn't have an inventory of wines. So we had to work with partners who really cared about customer service. So find stores, have their inventory, et cetera, and be able to create this model using this approach. So that's another example of logistics.
Excellent.
So that's a comprehensive radical strategy.
Excellent. I would like to come back to the real pain points. When you say real pain points and not imaginated, that means you really check that the people, your users, found those pain points real. How are you doing that?
Oh, great question. And this is often, you know, where we fall down as product people or in innovation in general. We often assume that a pain point is real because we think it is. And so the formula for figuring out whether a pain point is real is that you must validate a pain point. Validated equals verified plus valued. What this means is verified, you have to observe with your own eyes that someone has this pain. This means running user interviews or going out to the field and observing people in action to figure out if someone really has this pain point. And even when I talk about user interviews, we cannot ask the question directly saying, is this a pain point for you? Because even if it's not, people's mentality is usually to please you. And so they'll usually know why you're asking a question like this and give you the answer you're hoping to hear. And so a good user interview is one where you're asking questions that seem neutral, but you figure out through that what is a pain point. And the second piece of it is valued. Is someone willing to give up something or invest something in exchange for having that problem solved? So I'll give you an example. You know, even Facebook, if it's free, people are willing to invest their time into it. So there is some sort of an exchange. They're willing to give up their privacy. We'll talk about the ethics of this separately. But, you know, this question of verified plus valued is really important to be able to tell if a pain point you're solving is real.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I get it. I really like the equation. That's really, really useful. So moving on to prioritization, could you talk about its importance and how it's effectively implemented?
Yeah, one of the things that happens is, you know, we work on a vision and very often that vision gets filed away for posterity, you know, like, okay, we're done with that exercise. Let's move on with every day now. So prioritization is where we can bring that vision into our everyday decisions. And this is the most important thing for leadership. You know, very often we think that good leadership is about telling our teams what is priority number 1, 2, and 3. And what I've realized instead is good leadership is being able to scale your thinking, getting every person to understand your rationale for the trade-offs that you're making so that you don't have to be in that meeting. You don't have to be in every meeting and people know exactly what are the right trade-offs to make. That is good leadership, right? So how do you actually do that? Because a lot of your rationale as a leader comes from years of experience, and it's just intuition. You just know what is the right trade-off to make in that moment. So the hardest thing for leaders is to communicate your intuition. So in the radical product thinking way, the way you do that is, you know, when we are making these trade-offs, we're really trading off long-term against the short-term. It's the yin and yang of long-term versus short-term. So of course, you know, in engineering speak, this yin and yang gets converted into an X and a Y axis. So your Y axis is this a good vision fit or not? And the X axis is this good for survival or not? So now you have this X and Y of long-term versus short-term. Things that are good for the vision and good for survival, well, of course, those are the easy decisions, right? But if we always just focus on these easy decisions, then we're still being very myopic. So sometimes we need to do things that are investing in the vision. This quadrant is basically where it's good for the vision in the long term, but in the short term, it's not helping you survive. So an example of investing in the vision could be, you know, you might be refactoring code for 3 months, or you might be taking the time to do some user research. So your customers are not seeing immediate benefits, but it's important to do for the long run. So that's an example of investing in the vision. The opposite of that, by the way, is taking on vision debt. So vision debt is where it's good for survival, but it's not helpful for the long-term vision. So an example for this is, you know, if your customer says, you know, if you build this custom feature for me, then I will sign the contract. And so you do this once, twice, you keep doing this, it adds lots of vision debt. And over time, you catch the disease I call obsessive sales disorder. This is not to say that any of these quadrants are bad per se, but we have to be really mindful about how are we making these trade-offs. And so as a leader, when you decide that you need to take on this vision debt, one of the most important things is even recognizing and telling your team that, look, I understand that we need to win this deal, we're taking on vision debt. But at least by acknowledging that it's vision debt, you're not making the team feel like this is a top-down loss of confidence in the vision. I don't care about the vision. We're just going to do whatever the customer wants. At least your team feels like you get it. I understand your trade-off now.
Excellent. And you even discuss in the book the idea of a survival statement. In a way, you can have a product vision statement, but you can have also a survival statement to help all the team understand what you mean by survival at that moment in time.
Right, exactly. Because, you know, when we draw up this vision versus survival, one of the goals is to make these decisions less contentious. It's less about, well, I think we should do this. And you might say, no, I think we should do this. But when you draw up vision versus survival, now it makes the discussion, you know, more objective. Is it that we're not aligned on where this fits on the vision fit? Or is it that we're not aligned on, you know, how this is helping us survive or making survival harder? So this means, you know, we've defined the vision with a lot of clarity, answering the who, what, why, when, and how. But similarly, we should define what it means to survive, right? So if I'm a startup, survival for me means financial survival, that I need the money to survive. If I don't bring in the money, either through fundraising or if it's not helping me win a deal, my product is going to die because of financial survival. Whereas, let's say I'm in a big company, you know, maybe my company has the money in the bank. So what kills my product is not necessarily financial survival, but it might be stakeholder support, that maybe if my bosses don't approve of my job or don't approve of my product, then that's going to kill my product. And so survival might be pleasing stakeholders. So writing a survival statement is really helpful to acknowledge what that short term means, and so that you can actually do these objective trade-offs.
Really solve that paradox between long-term and short-term that's often difficult to solve. I love it. So now let's discuss execution and measurement. How does it fit into the radical product thinking framework? For me, it felt a little bit like you were making a case against the use, or maybe more accurately, the misuse of OKRs. But tell me more about all that.
Okay, perfect. You know, what I find is, like, okay, before we challenge OKRs directly, let's talk about what are we even trying to do with execution and measurement? What's the goal with execution and measurement? What we want to see is, we've created this great vision, we've created this great strategy. What we really want to know is it working? You know, how do I know if each piece of the strategy that I've crafted is working? That's really the crux of it. So execution and measurement is about creating a set of hypotheses so that I can understand, basically, for each element of this RDCL, you know, what is my hypothesis? And secondly, how will I measure whether this hypothesis is working or not? Like, is this hypothesis validated or not? Once I think about it in this way, now I ask the question about OKRs. You know, OKRs sets a bunch of goals. It tells you, you know, let's say, for example, that I have to hit 20,000 signups by the end of this quarter, or that we have to increase revenues by 20%. And all of this philosophy around OKRs is supposed to be these big, lofty goals that are really hard to achieve. Mm-hmm. And now you step back from that for a moment and you say, okay, but is it really helping me measure if the strategy is working or not? You know, the way targets and goals work, as a product manager, I have all the data behind the product, right? So, you know, the saying that goes lies, lies, and statistics. If you ask me to prove that I'm meeting my goals using my product statistics, you know, there is every bit of flexibility I can use in being able to show you that I am meeting those goals. Whereas what you really want to know is not whether I'm meeting those goals. You want to know, okay, how really is the product doing? Is the strategy working? Do we need to change our strategy? And so what that requires is a more collaborative approach. OKRs, on the other hand, don't feel collaborative. They're like an end of the exam, end of the year exam, right? You either pass it or you fail it. And the incentive that you're giving employees is to just show you that they have passed. And so it misaligns leadership's incentives against, you know, employees' incentives. What you want instead is a collaborative environment where employees are encouraged to share, okay, here was our strategy, and here's what is working, what's not working, what hypotheses we're observing. Maybe this is a new approach we need to take. And that's where I feel, and this is what I illustrate in the book, that instead of OKRs, we need to take this collaborative approach and being able to create hypotheses derived from our strategy and then metrics for how are we going to measure whether it's working or not.
Excellent. Yeah, in a way, that's why I was stating misuse of OKRs, because I feel what you describe could exactly be OKRs if we were doing it properly at a team level, at a product level, and certainly not for individuals, and certainly not linked to their composition and things like that. That will necessarily skew the system completely.
I really agree with you there. And I think, you know, the way OKRs have traditionally, or how you want to use them, people have traditionally wanted to use them because, you know, vision statements were super fluffy, like, you know, revolutionizing wireless. And if that's a fluffy vision, then OKRs were meant to really give a clearer narrative of what's the impact we're trying to have. What are we really trying to do? And that intention was good, but doing that in the form of just numbers leads to a lot of, you know, what they call sandbagging, meaning, you know, if I want to set these numbers to be super high, you know, it reduces ambition. Even from the most ambitious people within the company, they'll want to set lower targets because it feels like, you know, what if I fail? And I agree that we definitely should not create OKRs for personal goals and definitely not for product teams, because that leads to lies and statistics. But even when we create OKRs at an overall, you know, company level, if we don't do it right, there's a lot of temptation to want to do sandbagging, to not, you know, want to feel that personal responsibility of showing that maybe my department failed or something like that, right?
Yeah. So that brings us really greatly to culture, which is the last part of the framework. Can you tell us more about culture, what you mean by it, and why it's important?
Yeah. So one of the key things for innovation overall is that we want to create a culture where innovation thrives. And this means that people need a shared sense of a vision, like a shared sense of purpose. They need autonomy. And the last thing is they need the psychological safety to be able to innovate. So the first two are really covered by other elements of radical product thinking. You know, the sense of shared purpose comes from the vision. The autonomy comes from helping people understand how you make trade-offs. So the vision versus survival, and giving people the tools to be able to make those decisions like you would. And so this last piece, psychological safety, is really a question of how do you create that in your team? And how do you create a culture where, you know, people feel like they're doing meaningful work and not distracted by, you know, just bad things in the company, like politics, etc. So an important element of designing culture is working through this question of, you know, how are employees perceiving company culture? Because culture may not be what you intend, may be different from what people are experiencing. So think about culture on two dimensions. One is work fulfilling or not? And the other dimension is whether work is urgent or not. So if you draw up this 2x2, it leads to 4 quadrants. The most wonderful time at work is when you're doing something that feels fulfilling to you and it's not urgent. You know, this is the meaningful work quadrant where I can sit down, work through strategy, and I'm thinking through hypotheses, etc. When I'm interacting in a good way with my colleagues, all of that feels like it's meaningful work.
That's what I call the impact and satisfaction. And that's always what I'm trying to drive. It's to get to that quadrant of I am having an impact. That's really a positive impact. And I'm really satisfied by the work I'm doing to get to that impact. So I'm totally aligned with you on that. Sorry, I cut you. Go on.
No, not at all. And in fact, so I really agree with you. And what we want to maximize in our workplace is exactly what you said. We want to maximize this quadrant. So what are the quadrants that we want to minimize? Those quadrants, like one is the heroism quadrant. This is where work is fulfilling, but it's urgent. And so a little bit of this is like adding spice to your workday. You know, for example, if you're saving a customer after a disaster that happened or something like that, you know, that is heroism. And yes, a little bit of this once in a while adds spice. But you do this all the time and it's exhausting and it's the fast track to burnout. The next quadrant is what I call organizational cactus. This is basically work that is not fulfilling, but it's urgent. It's the stuff I have to get done. Like, for example, the expense reports, you know, all the invoicing and billing, like timesheets I might have to put together, for example, or all the consensus I have to get from all the different stakeholders to be able to make one small decision. That can get exhausting in itself. And so that is organizational cactus, where you feel like you're trudging through a cactus field. And then the last quadrant is the soul-sucking quadrant. This is basically where it is not fulfilling and is not urgent, but this is something you're dealing with all the time. So examples of this would be feeling like you're being unfairly treated at work, or that you have to constantly manage your boss, or feeling like you're not valued. So this is like a low-grade fever that just happens all the time. And so a good culture maximizes meaningful work and minimizes the other three quadrants. And so how do you arrive at that? Now, this is where you can use the other elements of radical product thinking. So you have a vision now for what a good culture is. you know, based on these quadrants and what a good culture looks like. Next, you can build a strategy. Instead of trying to solve all problems, start to define what are the pain points that creates time for you in the bad danger quadrants, right? And then you can work on the strategy with hypotheses and measurements. So in terms of execution, you know, you have a plan based on your strategy. You know, these are the pain points. So these are the solutions, perhaps maybe capabilities is training that someone needs, etc., or coaching. Then you can do this execution and measure over time. Are things working better in your culture? Are you gelling better as a team? So the way I use this approach is you can use this almost like a retrospective with your team to be able to evaluate culture and continue to work on your culture over time.
Hmm. I really love it because then we can use the framework to improve the culture of the organization, really consider the organization itself as a product that will serve the employees to help them do their best work. I really love that.
I love what you said, because what you said is exactly right. Like, that is the mindset of product, where you realize that your organization itself, you know, and the change you want to create, you have a vision for that change, and culture becomes your product, your mechanism for creating that change.
Yeah. And that's a little bit like, it's really about what your work is. It's really about making better products, but it's not only that. It goes beyond that. It's about making the world better by creating those different changes.
That's beautiful. I love how you framed it.
Radhika, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast on emerging leadership and for sharing your invaluable insights on radical product thinking.
Alexi, thank you for having me on this podcast. I really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you for the insightful questions. So in terms of how people can reach me, of course, there's the Radical Product Thinking book, which is in bookstores. They can also learn more on the blog that I have on radicalproduct.com. And finally, I always love to hear how people are applying the Radical Product Thinking approach to create change in the world. So you're welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn to share how you're applying Radical Product Thinking.
I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot from our conversation and will take away some important lessons on leadership, innovation, and making a positive impact through their work. To our listeners, you can find transcripts of this episode, references, and more episodes of the podcast on emerging leadership at emergingleadership.network. Join us next time as we continue our exploration into leadership, innovation, and the future of work. Thank you, and till then, keep leading the change.